parents, welcome to another episode of the Extraordinary Moms Podcast. I'm Jessica Dahlquist, your host, and every Tuesday I interview a different mom who shares their motherhood journey and the lessons they've learned along the way. We have had the full gamut of moms, and I hope that a huge takeaway from this podcast is that no two extraordinary moms look the same. You may be doing a fabulous job utilizing your own strengths, and it may look vastly different from another extraordinary mom that you know. There's room in the kingdom for everybody. And it's so important to not compare ourselves to each other, because you can be doing such an extraordinary job and so can the person sitting next to you at the park. And you do not have to be doing it exactly the same way. And that's the beauty of motherhood. We are all able to utilize our own strengths to the benefit of our children. And it's a work in progress. We're never done striving to be the best mom possible to our children. So have confidence in your abilities and celebrate yourself today and acknowledge that you are doing a great job. So thanks for joining us today on today's podcast. Let's see, if you're not already following me on social media, I'd love to have you. On Instagram, I'm at JessicaDahlquist3. On Facebook, you can follow the podcast page at Extraordinary Moms Podcast. And of course, there's the website to get more information at ExtraordinaryMomsPodcast.com. So I hope everyone's having a great week so far. I have a great episode for you today. Today I'm talking with Amy Merkley. Amy is a mom of two boys, both of whom have type 1 diabetes. And prior to the diagnosis, she knew nothing about the disease. And so she's had a steep learning curve. And boy, has she given her heart and soul to taking care of her sons. It has, you know, created a lot of sacrifice on her part, a lot of heartache watching her children struggle at times. But it is such an inspiring story to see how she's turned something so hard into something beautiful that she's really passionate about sharing with the community now and empowering others to help their children in their own personal fights. So I hope you enjoy my interview with Amy today. All right, I want to welcome Amy Merkley to the show today. Hi, Amy.
Hello.
How are you doing today?
Doing well.
Good. Where am I speaking to you from today?
I am in American Fork, Utah.
Awesome. I lived in Utah for a few years, and it's just beautiful. I love that area.
Yes, that's great.
That's awesome. Well, I knew your sister, Jill, and she is the one that recommended you for the podcast, and she told me a little bit about your background, and I'm like, yes, I need to talk to Amy, because you have a great story, and you truly are an extraordinary mom. So we're going to dive more into your story in just a sec, but for the listeners, let's give them a little bit more of a background on who you are.
Okay. I guess first and foremost, I would consider myself a wife and mom. But aside from that, I am a musician. I am a pianist. I have a bachelor's and master's degree in piano performance. And I'm married to a wonderful husband named Chris, and I have two sons. And I have a private piano studio where I teach about 20 students, and it's been a great career to have with my family.
That is so awesome. I grew up singing, and I also took piano lessons for a few years, but I have a problem reading the music ahead of my fingers, and so it just never worked out. And I can still play the entertainer, but that's like, that's it. And I can do like warm-ups and stuff for myself and play the right hand on things, but I'm praying that one of my kids will be gifted so that I can have an accompanist, because that's seriously lacking in my life.
So it's been really good. It's brought me a lot of joy.
Oh, that's awesome. And yeah, and I love when you're able to, I taught voice lessons, and so I love teaching that kind of talent to other people who are then able to spread that joy to other people. And it just like keeps, the ripple effect keeps going. I think it's a great thing.
Yes, it does. Mm-hmm. Yeah. For sure.
Well, that's awesome. Well, great. Well, let's jump into you as a mom. So tell me about the time in your life when you wanted to start your family and those early days of motherhood, and just go back to that time.
Okay. Well, I had finished my master's degree and we were ready to start a family. Didn't come quite as quickly as we'd hoped. But about 4 years later, I had my first little boy and we named him Will. And I think my feelings were probably the same as every other mother. It was wonderful. It was exhausting. It was hard to comprehend that you had a place in your heart that could be that big for a new one. And I think, you know, it started out just the same as any other mother. just, it was a wonderful new experience in my life.
Was it what you expected, or were there any things that surprised you?
I think, you know, pretty much as I expected. Probably I was a little surprised by how overwhelmingly, I guess, great the responsibility was, but mm-hmm. also the fact that I had zero control over my life from here on out.
Yeah. Are you a type A person?
I kind of am, yeah.
Yeah. And motherhood is the cure for a lot of type A personalities, or at least a way to kind of make you less so.
Right.
Yeah, because it's out of your control a lot of the time, even from the time they can't speak.
Right.
It is crazy. So everything's going along swimmingly, and then something happened when he was about 10 months old. Tell me about that.
Well, we noticed that he had started leaking through a lot of his diapers. And, you know, I'm a first-time mom, and I just thought, oh, I just need a bigger size diapers. And so we did that with no success. He was eating everything in sight, but yet he was losing weight. And as this was going along, my first thought was, gosh, this is kind of what happens with diabetes. But yet we have no family history or anything, and so I just dismissed it. And just went on feeding him. He was eating as much as I was, and he was 10 months old and yet losing weight.
Wow.
But you can always rationalize away, you know, these problems. And it just kept getting worse, doing this kind of the same thing. And then one of the days of my life that I will never forget, I was getting ready to teach piano for the day. So I took him down to my mom's house. She was going to babysit while I was teaching, and I dropped him off, and I said, you know, I don't think he feels very good, you know, maybe he doesn't even want to eat that day, so I thought maybe he's sick, so I just kind of said, let him just chill for a while, and I'll be back and see how he was doing, and about 3 hours later, I finished teaching, and I went back to get him, and my mom said, you know, he just really acts like he doesn't feel good. And I went and picked him up, and his breathing was very, very heavy. It would have been you and me running, you know, a mile as fast as we can, and he was breathing like that, but yet he has just been laying there,
right,
you know.
Right.
So I thought, okay, something is wrong, obviously. And so I said, well, I think I need to take him to the doctor. But luckily my dad is a doctor, and so he wasn't home. But I called him on his cell phone, and I said, Dad, I think he's sick, and I kind of described the symptoms to him, and I think he kind of had a little bit of an idea, and he said, keep giving him liquids, I'll be home in an hour. So I did, and at this point, he started throwing up, and when my dad got home, we took him over to the hospital, and my dad checked his blood sugar. It was over 500. A normal blood sugar is between like 70 and 120. So wow. For 500 obviously is huge. My dad is very even keel. And so by looking at him, I could tell by the look on his face that this was not good. And so he said, we need to go up to Primary Children's Hospital, which is the, you know, children's special hospital in Utah and for the whole Intermountain West. And my mom said, you know, let's get some dinner first, just make sure everything's good, and then you can go. And my dad said, no, we need to go right now. And I was starting to panic.
Yeah.
We drove to the hospital. My husband was working in Salt Lake, and so I called him, and he met us there. My dad drove, and I sat in the back seat with my little Will, trying to get him to drink some water, which he just kept throwing up. Anyway, we got to the emergency room at the Children's Hospital. They took him straight in. My dad told him what the blood sugar was at. And they said, okay, we need to get an IV in him because he's very dehydrated. And obviously his blood sugar is so high, he needs some insulin. He was so dehydrated that his blood vessels had pretty much collapsed because there wasn't enough fluid to keep them open. And he's 10 months old anyway. And so there's not really, you know, they're not big veins. Anyway. So they tried for about 45 minutes, poking him in every possible place on his body, trying to get an IV in, and it didn't work. And, of course, he was screaming because they're poking him the whole time.
Yeah.
The bad thing is then he stopped screaming, and he just kind of laid there, just lifeless, basically. And that was scary, honestly. It was one of the worst, probably, experiences of my life. And right. Yeah, finally, a new doctor came in and said, let's try in his temple, in his head. And luckily, he was able to get an IV in right there in the temple. And they were able to get some fluid into him and then get some insulin into him and get his blood sugar down. Anyway, that was our diagnosis experience. He ended up in the ICU overnight. And from that point, we, you know, obviously received our diagnosis and kind of had to start over with a new plan of how we were going to attack life. So that's what happened. Yeah.
Is it typical for that kind of decline to be so quickly with type 1 diabetes?
Well, the problem is we had been noticing, you know, these kind of little symptoms for quite a while. But, you know, he was so little and we had no risk factors that we could discount them. But looking back, even looking at scrapbook pictures, you can see the paleness in his face for several weeks. And so it wasn't that it came on so suddenly. It just came on without us being aware, basically.
But I think that's probably so common, right? I mean, like you said, you can kind of explain away a lot of these kinds of symptoms or attribute it to other things. He probably had just been to the doctor at 9 months and been given a clean bill of health, I mean, to your knowledge. And so I'm sure a lot of parents would do the same exact thing that you did.
Yeah. And, you know, you can beat yourself up over it, but it's just, it is. It's easy to talk it out, you know, and explain it away. So, so yes, it was one of those, they did tell us in the ER, had we waited 12 hours to bring him in, he probably would have died. And so it was very, obviously a life changer, one of the worst nights of my life, but we learned a lot from that. Yeah.
Yeah. So going forward, so after that night in the ICU, was there still a fear for if he was going to be okay, or was it just like, okay, now he has the diagnosis and now we can start to kind of move forward with this new normal?
You know, that's one thing I'm really grateful for is that because we knew what the diagnosis was, as soon as they got the fluid into him and got his blood sugar down, he really was out of the woods as far as, you know, oh, is he going to make it or not?
So, okay, that's great.
And honestly, because we had come so close to losing him, hearing the diagnosis was almost a relief because I thought, okay, I don't care what it is. He's alive.
I can work with this. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And having said that, I was pretty clueless about diabetes at the time. Yeah. You know, all the myths that you hear growing up, that's what I had heard.
Yeah.
And so I thought, okay, well, if that means we can't have any sugar or chocolate in our house, then at least he's alive, you know?
Right.
And I didn't realize that that was a myth as well. So it was the start of a whole new learning process. We spent about a week in the hospital with him, with all of the dietitians and nurses and training us on how to take care of him. And then off we went into normal life again. So,
wow. So tell me about that new normal. Tell me the things that you learned and the basics for people that have no idea if they've never walked this path before.
Okay. So basically, maybe I'll just describe a day in the life for him. So, like I told you before, normal blood sugar is between 70 and 120. And so we have a blood sugar monitor that we would check him with. And usually, especially at that little young age, we would check him probably every 2 hours. So, you know, 10, 11, 12 times a day, he's getting poked to get his blood sugar checked.
And during the night as well.
Yes. Yeah. There were a lot of sleepless nights.
Wow.
you know, because especially then they're 10 months old, they can't communicate if they're feeling low or if they just don't feel good or whatever. So yes, kind of around the clock. And then, you know, if their blood sugar is high, then you need to give them another shot of insulin. If it's low, they need to eat some sugar to kind of balance it out. So a typical day is that we'll check for breakfast, and then he would eat breakfast. The way it works is you have to count up how many carbs he ate, and then there's a ratio. For however many carbs, this is how many units of insulin you need to have to counteract that. So then you give them a shot after they eat, and then wait, in 2 hours, you start all over and do it again.
Wow.
So you check. And if they're going to eat something, great. You count up how many carbs. If not, you just kind of make sure they're in a good range and then go. With a baby, that wasn't so bad just because, you know, he was always with me. He was always in constant watch and care. And then of course that changes as they grow and go to school and do all of that kind of thing too.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah.
Wow. So did it affect what he could eat and what he couldn't eat?
That is a great question. That's one of those myths that I thought
Yeah.
was true, is that, oh, you can't eat any sugar or whatever. And that really is just not true. He can eat anything he wants. We obviously would try to eat healthy, but he has his fair share of treats. It's just that those treats carry a lot more carbs, obviously, with the sugar. And so they just have to have a lot more insulin to cover for that.
Got
So
it.
it didn't really change what we ate. Sometimes it would change what time we ate. You know, if he was low, we would eat a little earlier or something like that
Right.
and bring it up. But as far as, you know, eating habits, not too much different.
Okay, that's really interesting. Yeah, it's amazing how these myths kind of get perpetuated in society, and you might think you know what it looks like in a child, but really you have no idea.
Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Wow. So then you went on to have your second son, and were you fearful that he would also have it? Is it genetic?
Well, you know, it's funny because we talked to our endocrinologist, who I absolutely love, and I said, "Now tell me, you know, if and when we have our next child, what are the chances that it's going to have this as well?" And she said, "You know, there's some risk factors, but to be perfectly honest, they don't know 100% what causes diabetes. They know there's a little bit of a genetic link. So family history, you know, if a parent has it or something, then that's more of a link. And there could be some genetic factors with environmental triggers. But she said, you have none of these risk factors. So we're just going to say that Will getting diabetes was kind of a fluke. And so, you know, but you've been through it once, and so the mother paranoia kicks in, and you kind of worry that maybe your second one will get it as well, but he really had no reason to get it. So we weren't too concerned about it. I would say that my second son, Jake, was born, and he is almost exactly 3 years younger than Will. And he was doing great. But I do have to say that, you know, when we hit that 10-month-old mark, there was that little bit of, okay, we made it past 10 months. Maybe we're just good and we're out of the woods. And I already knew of the symptoms, of course, because I had become an expert on what the symptoms were after Will was diagnosed. So we always started watching for them, and I never worried about it until he was about 17 months old and noticed that he started drinking a lot. He was thirsty all the time. And that is one of the very first symptoms, warning signs of diabetes. And I was a little worried about it, but I said, you know what? He's just thirsty. It's okay. And we let him go. And about 4 days later, it was not getting any better, and he was drinking constantly. And I thought, you know what? I can't do this any longer. I've just got to check and see. So we had family in town. It was actually my sister Jill's wedding that weekend. And we had family in town from all over, and I said, I've just got to find out. So I used Will's blood sugar monitor, and I checked his blood sugar, and it was over 500 as well. And I just stared at it in disbelief, like, no, there's something wrong. The monitor's wrong, you know. So I checked it again and said the same thing. I showed my husband, and we just kind of stared at each other. And it was interesting because, you know, whereas Will, we didn't catch his diagnosis early. Now with Jake's, I think we caught it very early because we had seen that warning sign. And I called our doctor and I said, "This is the situation. Do you still think it was a fluke that Will was diagnosed?" And she said, "Obviously not. There's something going on, genetics or, you know, something like that." Anyway, it was a very, very different diagnosis experience than Will's, but I would say equally traumatizing. With Will's, we almost lost him, and I didn't care what the diagnosis was because he was alive. But by the time Jake was diagnosed, I knew what he was going to face and what he was up against in life, and I knew how hard it was. And so I didn't have the risk of losing him that day, but it was just equally devastating to know that, wow, he's going to have to deal with this as well.
That's really interesting that you bring that up, how even though your experiences were very different, and you might think like, oh, well, if you've been down this road before, it'll be easy for you to kind of accept that another child has it. But I totally get how you never want that for any of your children. And it's like, darn it, again? But I mean, at least you were armed with knowledge and the ability to, you know, create this new normal again for your second son, which is great to have that tool set already. But I see how that would be devastating in a different way.
Yeah, it was, and it was one of those that, if anything, I had to be grateful that if they were both going to get hit with something, I was very grateful it was the same thing, because they will understand each other throughout their lives in a way that I can't, because I don't know how it feels to have a blood sugar at 800, and I don't know how it feels to have a blood sugar at 40 and feel horrible, but they do.
Yeah.
And so even today I'll hear them having conversations about, well, how do you feel when you're that low? Well, I feel like this. And they really? Totally get it with each other too.
Yeah. It's kind of a special bond in an ironic kind of way.
It is. Absolutely.
I have one more specific question about type 1 diabetes. Is there a reason that some children get diagnosed in infancy and others later on? Like,
you know,
what's the onset?
That is a fantastic question. The average age for a diabetes diagnosis is between 6 and 12 years old.
Oh, interesting.
That's the average. Yeah. But, you know, they've had people diagnosed into their 30s. And I have heard of one as young as 2 months old being diagnosed, and there could be even younger. So my boys were both on the very young side, but that is the average, 6 to 12.
Okay, so it's kind of random when the symptoms present themselves, but there's
right.
a typical window, but you don't have to fall in that typical window.
Right.
I see. Thanks for answering that. I've always wondered that. That's really interesting. That's really interesting. So now that you've adopted this new normal, how has this changed your whole life and your perspective on motherhood and the way that you view these precious boys of yours?
Well, I think for me, I will forever remember their diagnosis dates. I will never forget those days. And it's almost, at first it was a very painful date to remember. But at this point, it's almost a celebratory date, because those are the dates that we figured out what was wrong and how to keep them alive.
Yeah.
And so it's almost a celebration. And I think I've gained, I guess, the perspective to see what it's like to almost lose your child and how awful that was, and to try to cherish them more.
Yeah.
And to do, you know, to think about what's really important now. And you get busy in everyday life, and sometimes that gets hard.
Yeah.
And, you know, just because I'm so grateful to have them doesn't mean they don't get in trouble sometimes.
Yeah.
But,
yeah.
But, you know, just to appreciate the fact that they are alive and that they're here. They get a lot of squeezes that I just am so grateful that I can give them.
Yes.
And I would say that, especially when they were younger babies with it, I was probably a lot more protective than I would have been. But I think just the idea that I'm so grateful that there are miracles in medicine that will keep them alive. 100 years ago, they would have just died. There wouldn't have been hope.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I have a 9-month-old right now, and one of the things that I think is so powerful about hearing stories from other mothers is that you don't have to be going through the same thing as somebody else in order to learn from their story and to glean from their perspective. I mean, no one would ever wish that somebody else's child were on the brink of death or anything like that, but to hear your story, I can put myself in your shoes. I'm picturing my little baby right now and how that would feel, and it feels like, you know, I can empathize with you, even though I've never actually been through that. And so I think it's so powerful to share these stories, because, you know, it can just give you such additional perspective. And, you know, guaranteed after hearing this, you know, you're going to look at your kids a little differently today, and you're going to give them that squeeze, and you're going to acknowledge, gosh, I'm so lucky. So lucky.
Yeah, for sure.
That's huge. Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I guess my next question is, how do the boys deal with it? What do they, I mean, I know that they have this special bond, which is really neat that they have each other for support, but, you know, how do they feel in the context of their classroom at school and their friend circle and sports and things like that, or whatever they're into?
You know, it's interesting, because most kids are diagnosed between 6 and 12, they have the knowledge of what it was like to not have diabetes.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a huge adjustment for them to start their new normal. And so, not that I would ever wish that, you know, somebody else would have a child diagnosed as young as mine, But it did make it so that they don't know anything different. This is their normal life. And so they do not really view themselves as different because yeah. this is the way they've always been. In their classrooms, the kids have been incredibly accepting, and it's really a non-issue for them in class. They both have insulin pumps, and so they hook them on their belts. They're very visible, so people can see them. They'll get the occasional question, "Hey, what's that that's on your belt or whatever?" And, you know, sometimes people have said, "Why?" In fact, somebody asked me once, "Why does your child have a garage door opener on his belt?" And I said, "You know, I don't usually put my 2-year-old in charge of the garage door opener." So, and it was a great opportunity to teach them yeah. what that actually was.
Right.
But, you know, they've dealt with it very well, and they treat it very matter-of-factly, and mm-hmm. so everybody else does too. And it's been a really positive experience. When they were younger, I did go into their class at the beginning of the year and kind of explain it and just see if the kids had any questions because, you know, kindergartners are very curious.
Right.
So it really has been a non-issue in their classes. Both of my boys are very active. They both play on baseball teams and, they've done soccer and flag football and, you know, lots of running, lots of things like that. And the difference it is between the way they do those sports and the way everybody else does is we just check. We check their blood sugar before the event starts and during it if we have to. And we've always got snacks on hand, either fruit snacks or juice boxes or mm-hmm. things like that. And then they go, I remember the day that Will was diagnosed, our doctor came to us and she said, "I know this has been a very traumatic day, but I want you to know there is nothing in this world that your kids cannot do." Mm. And so that stuck with me a lot that this, I do not want this to be something that they feel like inhibits them from participating in life in any way. And so we've tried really hard to make it so it's not a crutch.
Yeah.
It's something we deal with. And yes, it's a pain in the rear, but mm-hmm. we deal with it and we move on and we just do our lives.
Yeah, I think that's so important to teach your kids that. And I was talking to somebody else the other day whose child had a different diagnosis, but she said, you know, I want people to realize that she is a lot of things besides just that.
Yes.
Besides just that label. Yes, she has this. And yes, your sons have type 1 diabetes. But they're way more than that. They're not
right.
just that. They are
yes.
smart and athletic and fun and funny. And the list goes on. And they have brown hair or blue eyes or whatever.
Right.
And so, yeah, boxing them into just, oh gosh, your child has this and acting like it's all consuming. Even though some days it might feel like that to you,
right.
you know, I'm sure. But just realizing that's just one aspect of them. And I think that's really important to realize for all children.
Yes, I agree. They do not like being called, somebody will say, "Oh, are you diabetic?" They do not like that because
okay.
that it does, it labels them. And he says, "No, I'm Will and I have diabetes, but I am not diabetic," you know.
Oh, that's interesting. Is that common in the diabetes community to use that type of language? Like I know for autism, you'd say a child who has autism. It's not
right.
proper to say an autistic child.
Right.
So is that common?
It's pretty common. I think it's changing a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I just think it's better to just say you are this person. You
yeah.
happen to have this.
Yeah.
But you're not that. You're not your disease or you're not your condition type thing.
Yeah, I think that's a really important distinction. I like that. I didn't realize that would be true with this type of thing, but of course it would be. It's
yeah.
just another diagnosis.
Yeah.
Yeah. So are you still getting up in the middle of the night to test them?
Yes.
Wow.
So I just have a permanent alarm set for about 2 a.m., and then I just get up and check them once just to make sure everything's going good. I check them right before they go to bed, or they check themselves now that they're
yeah.
getting older.
How old are they?
So Will is 12 and Jake is 9. So
mm-hmm.
they're getting a little older, but yeah, I do just make sure. And probably 80% of the time I just check them. Things are great. And I go back to bed. Occasionally they'll be really high, or really low and we just try and take care
yeah.
of it. But
wow.
it's just a peace of mind, I think, just
yeah.
to make sure we're okay through the night.
Wow. That's really impressive. So you're never going to be able to just leave that newborn stage of sleeping through the night. You poor thing.
No, been there a while, but
oh.
it's okay. It's all right. It's worth it.
It's amazing how you can just adjust to these types of schedules and things. And it's like, That's, yeah. Moms are amazing. Moms are amazing.
You do what you have to, right?
You do. It's worth it. It's better than the consequence of not doing it, for sure.
Right.
So you've become really involved in the community now, as this has become really personal to your family. Tell me about your activism role now and how you spread information in the community and things like that.
Okay. You know, the reason I got involved in doing a lot of these kind of community things is the fact that when you get a diagnosis like this, you feel helpless. You feel like you have no control whatsoever. And so this was a way for us to kind of fight back and say, you know what, I can't control this, but I can control what I do with it. Mm-hmm. And so we first got involved in, it's our local chapter of Juvenile Diabetes Research Foundation, or most commonly known as JDRF. It's an international research charity. And so all the money raised goes to research for treatment and cures of diabetes. And so they have a walk to cure, kind of like a lot of the other charities do. We got involved in that. Fabulous experience. And I ended up being on the committee to plan our county walk every year. And it's just a great way to say, I can do something about this.
Yeah.
So we've done a lot of fundraising and things for that as well. One of the highlights is we applied to be representatives from our state to go back to Washington, D.C. and do some lobbying before our congressmen and senators for funding for diabetes research. And so in 2013, we were selected, both of my boys were, as delegates from the state of Utah. And in that summer of 2013, we went back to Washington, D.C. and met with all the other delegates from all the other states. And it was a fabulous experience. We were able to go to a Senate hearing and participate in that, lobbying for the research funding, meet with all of our senators, and then just meet all these other kids that were their delegates, and just, it was a fabulous experience. And we were successful in being able to get that funding bill passed. That was a really, really neat thing. And then just locally, we have our county council, we call it, that really tries to promote kind of some outreach programs. We've sponsored programs to help new families that are diagnosed, because you kind of feel just completely overwhelmed. And so trying to help them, I'm a mentor who gets assigned families that have been recently diagnosed. And we present them with something that JDRF calls a bag of hope. And it has just a lot of information, supplies, kind of a TLC kit, just to kind of help them as they start in with this. And it's been a really good way to do something positive with a really crummy diagnosis and to kind of help people. So it's been a really, really good experience, and a lot of research is coming and new experiments and trials. It's good, really good stuff coming.
That's amazing. Wow. I love that idea of mentoring new families, because I mean, you remember that day where you knew little to nothing about, or like of reliable information about type 1 diabetes. And so to be able to help walk through that with another mom where you felt those feelings and you have been in that unknown place, and to be able to walk with them through that as they're learning the new language. And I mean, they don't have a medical background necessarily, and they don't, so they're just learning all of this stuff, and it's life or death for their children.
Right, so, it is.
Wow,
and, you know,
have that
we talk about moms, and I understand the medical and the emotional and the physical, you know, process that my boys go through, but I don't understand how they feel.
Yeah.
But when I talk with a mom that's in the same position I was, I have an instant connection with that mom. We have an instant bond that we understand each other on a level that I can't with other moms, you know?
Yes.
And so it's a very good way to just say, hey, hang in there. It's going to be okay.
Yeah. I love that. I'm sure that gives them so much peace of mind in that very scary time.
Yeah.
That's so
yeah.
great. That's why I think it's so important for us to all share our individual stories, because, you know, getting a diagnosis like that or going through an experience that's really hard can be so isolating. And oftentimes you feel like nobody really gets it and no one's going through anything, and life is buzzing on around you, but you are in this pit and you're like, what do I do? Or who do I talk to? So to have people there that get it just has to be huge for them.
Yeah.
I love that you're doing
that. It definitely is.
I love that you're doing that. That's awesome. Well, obviously, that's been a really positive byproduct of diabetes in your family. Are there any other ways in which this disease has actually, you know, contributed positively to your family culture or to your boys or to you?
You know, I keep a diabetes journal because it really is a place for me to vent if we've had a particularly hard day or just frustrating day. And I, you know, in preparing for this interview, I was flipping through it and just kind of looking back at some of the experiences we've had. And one day I wrote a page on what I've lost since our diagnosis. And then I put that with a page on what I've gained since diagnosis. And and it was interesting as I was looking back, the things that we've lost since our diagnosis. The number one thing I put was a lot of sleep. And a lot of peace of mind because I don't really ever go a day without a pit in my stomach that we're going to have a really low blood sugar that's going to result in a seizure or hospitalization or something like that. So I probably have gained an ulcer, maybe. I don't know.
That's not positive, Amy.
Peace of mind. I feel like I've lost a lot of tears. And then I was looking at my journal the other day, and the last thing was a repetition of I've lost a lot of sleep. So a lot of that. But then I contrasted that with what have I gained? And I think you kind of touched on it earlier, how you gain empathy. And I don't understand every single person's challenge, but because of mine, I have a glimpse of maybe some of the pain that somebody else is going through. And so maybe I can be a little more sympathetic or empathetic with them because of that. I have learned to never take my children for granted. And it's not just because they have diabetes. It's because that they are an amazing spirit that needs to be nurtured. And to never take that for granted. And to never take for granted the fact that I'm lucky enough to be a mom, you know, and that I have these kids. I've learned gratitude. I think it's changed our family as far as how much gratitude we have for doctors, for medicine, you know, for people that are willing to help, for those that are just concerned, you know. As our, as Will was diagnosed and he was in the hospital, I didn't leave the hospital. So I was up there for 4 weeks or 4 days. And when we got home, my house was clean. My yard was immaculate. I had flowers sitting, you know, people had just come out of everywhere to help us, and just that gratitude for that. And then I think we are very more keenly aware of miracles that happen in our lives because of times when I feel like I'm inspired to say, ooh, we better check your blood sugar because you might be low. And, you know, and to feel that, and then to just realize that there's hope. There's so much coming in the form of research, in the form of just treatments, so that even before a cure comes, that the lifestyle and the quality of life is improving every day. So, you know, we could sit and I should say this too, after Jake was diagnosed, I like to run and my dad does too. And so that's how I was going to vent that day after he was diagnosed and we went running and he said, well, you know, we don't have much of a choice in this, so we can just sit down and cry about it, or we can just get back up and just keep on moving and be positive. And I guess that's the other thing we learned, is you just keep on going. And that's one thing I think that's amazing about moms, is you have your days where you just feel like you can't do anymore, and then you do. So it's been an interesting learning process.
Yeah, the term mom endurance is coming to mind. Like, moms have this incredible, like, from the get-go, from that day one where you first become a mother, suddenly you are fitted with an endurance that you never knew that you had. And there are going to be hard, hard days, and there are going to be blissful days, and there are going to be diagnoses, and there are going to be celebrations, and you're going to get through every single minute of every single day if you just keep going. If you but you have to put one foot in front of the other. And doesn't mean you're not allowed to grieve the diagnosis. It doesn't mean you're not allowed to be sad or wish that something were different, but you can choose to keep going through it. And you can do so with a lot of hope, like you're saying, and you can choose your attitude even if you can't choose your circumstances.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow, this is just such a powerful message, and I'm so excited for the listeners to hear from you, Amy.
Oh, thank you.
You went on and on about all you gained, and I mean, it's just like, that is it. That is the crux of the issue. You can still see positive things coming from something that is originally a negative.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the beauty of life, and I just am so encouraged by you, and I just think you're extraordinary. All right, well, I always ask one final question to all my guests, and it's this. What would you tell your pre-motherhood self?
Oh, wow. I would like to tell my pre-motherhood self, don't sweat the small stuff, but I do sweat the small stuff, so I probably can't tell myself that. But I think if I could only say one thing, I would probably just say, don't worry about anything that's coming. It's worth it. You get one hug from them, one smile, and that's all it takes to remind you that everything you do, no matter what the sacrifice is, it's worth it.
Yeah. I mean, how many times do you hear something and learn it the very first time? So I think, like you're saying, I would tell myself, don't sweat the small stuff, but I still do. It can still be a mantra in your head, and you don't have to be perfect at it in order to still have that be the thing that still is your goal, you know? Like, pre- and post-motherhood self needs to know, don't sweat the small stuff. But yeah, enjoying every moment, and I think that's so important as well.
Yeah.
Amy, you are so inspiring, and I know the listeners are going to really love your story and get so much out of how you turned tragedy into something so hopeful and an amazing life. And look at the way you're contributing to society now. It's beautiful. So thank you for sharing your journey.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been awesome. Well, thanks very much, and I hope you have a good day.
Okay, thank you.
Bye. I really want to thank Amy for being on the show today. Oh, she got so vulnerable as she shared that very personal story about being with Will when he was 10 months old in that hospital room. And I think we can learn so much from her about how she faced that diagnosis and how she still gets up in the middle of the night, even though they're 10 and 12 years old. And I mean, it is amazing the lengths moms are willing to go to make sure that their kids are well taken care of and thriving. And she is evidence that you can do hard things. So thanks, Amy, for sharing your story. As always, you can get up more information on the show notes page on our Extraordinary Moms Podcast website, extraordinarymomspodcast.com. You can follow me on Instagram, Jessica Dahlquist 3, or on Facebook, Extraordinary Moms Podcast. I hope you all have a great day, and I'm excited to see you on Friday for another fun episode. Have a great day.